He said he would, quote, round the students up when he was feeling better. But if I have time, well, I don't have time today, unfortunately, to run it. Maybe I can run it tomorrow if that's if you guys are willing to do that. If he's not better by then, of course. I don't know exactly what this means for the homework. Has this happened to you guys before? Do you know what the protocol is? Yeah, one way or the other. Well, the question is, should I try to get somebody to give it to you guys, or I can post it on the wiki or something, or just give it tomorrow?
I mean, whichever.
Yeah. It's not that big a deal, I think, either way.
He also did say he would try to be in the afternoon.
Okay. Okay. Okay, so then are there questions on stuff we've been doing? Not yet, I guess. Okay. So what I wanted to do today and tomorrow is to talk some about how one would actually build a quantum computer. Oh, yeah.
This is probably a bit off topic, but we had this tutorial on stabilizer codes.
Mm-hmm.
And I was just wondering, so like you use like the dot product of two, you know, things in Z2 to the N there. And like
right.
Right. And so the dot product, I guess, is degenerate.
So it's no longer gives you a good norm, for instance.
Right. So you so you lose things like the uniqueness of endpoints, I guess?
Let's see, I never thought about adjoints in a vector space over a finite field. I would imagine so. So in Z2, I mean, over Z2, it's all kind of trivial because.
Yeah. One of the questions on the homework was, or on the tutorial was like show that the dimension of, like, the
right.
orthogonal space, whatever it is,
mm-hmm.
like, and I know that's. I think a standard result, but or I think it is. But I was wondering. I just wanted to make sure that still holds in like.
Yeah. That does still hold basically. I mean, it's yeah. So it's these basic properties of linear algebra that used to all still work over finite fields. There may well be some more advanced properties that fail.
Yeah. Like I know the standard proof. I think that the dimension of the orthogonal space is n minus. Sorry. You know what I mean, right?
Yeah,
I think
yeah.
the standard proof.
Right, so, I mean, all the stuff about, you know, bases and dimensions of subspaces and stuff like that, basically that all holds in finite fields. There's other stuff that doesn't hold, and probably, like I said, but then again, there's other things that are true in finite fields that are not true or not known, for instance, in over real or complex. Okay, but none of that is going to be very relevant today. So like I said, today and tomorrow I wanted to talk about how one would build a quantum computer and how people actually are trying to build quantum computers. There's another whole course, the Explorations course on quantum information, which maybe some of you are planning to take, run by David Corey. And I'm not totally sure what he's going to do, but he's going to talk mostly about implementations. I think he's going to focus mostly on one that I'm not going to talk about, involving neutron interferometry. But it's possible he'll say something about other things. Okay, yeah. So he's an expert in NMR, so he might say something about that too. It used to be that when you went to a conference where somebody gave a talk about their implementation of quantum computing, they would always start with the DiVincenzo criteria. And this is not quite so true anymore, but it's still a pretty good way to start when you're talking about implementations. So David DiVincenzo suggested this list of criteria as, you know, properties or maybe simple milestones that you had to meet in order to say that you had, you know, a good candidate for a quantum computer. So what are they? So it turns out, actually, that these criteria are not really strictly necessary, nor are they actually sufficient to have a, to be able to build a big quantum computer. But you know, there's still pretty good things to say that you have a small working quantum device that, that kind of has the basic properties of a quantum computer. So, whoops. Okay, so for that piece. So what are these? So first one is you want a scalable physical system. With well characterized qubits. Okay, so the idea there is, well, first of all, you need to be able to have a qubit that's somehow encoded in this physical system, you know, a ground and excited state or whatever. And we'll talk about some different examples of those in the next few days. And it, of course, needs to be qubits. So not only do you need two distinct states, but you need to be able to have superpositions of those. And well characterized means that, you know, you understand the properties of the system. When you build one of them and a second one, it has, you know, kind of roughly the same properties. Or in any case, the properties are known and under control. And a scalable means that you could potentially at least build lots of these. There are some physical systems where, you know, maybe you can build one or two, but there's no way to build 1,000, for instance, because they interfere with each other in some way. So then the second criterion is the ability So the second is the ability to initialize the state to some standard starting state. So well, it's maybe clear why you need those. If your computer is starting in some kind of unknown arbitrary state, then, well, even if you can do whatever unitary operations you want on it, the answer you get out at the end doesn't really mean much because you don't know where you started. So this, I would say, tends not to be a really severe problem in most systems. Anything that you have enough control to do the other stuff, you can generally initialize. But you know, it's something to bear in mind. Okay. Fiducial just means it serves as a reference point. So it's the reference point where you start from. And I should say that frequently, what this means in practice is being able to cool the system, because you know, high temperature systems are in a thermal state, and then there's some randomness in the actual state of the system. Whereas the low temperature system has a much more predictable state, the ground state. So it may not be that the ground state is actually your computational state, but once you're the ground state, you can then move it to whatever you want. Since in later on, we're going to say that you have to have control. Okay. Third criterion, long relevant decoherence times. So the third one is long relevant decoherence times, much longer than the gate operation time. So decoherence Well, it can mean a couple of different things. There's kind of the Zurich quantum foundations use, which specifically means decoherence in some specific pointer basis, which is dephasing, basically, where you superpositions will go to mixtures of the basis states for this particular basis. But in quantum computing, it's often used more generally as, you know, some source of noise. So you start out with a pure state of the computer, and over time, this will interact with the environment, and it will accumulate errors. Okay. And the idea is that the length of time it takes for this to happen, or the length of time for it takes to become a significant effect, is much longer than the gate operation time, right? And that's clear. Well, there's two reasons why that's important. So one of them is that this means that your gate error rate at least is potentially low. So it doesn't say this in the criteria, but it's also true that the control errors should be small when you do a gate. In order really to have a candidate system, if your qubits are decohering on a timescale comparable to your control timescale, that means that your error rate per gate is inherently going to be very large. And then, of course, the other reason is that you want to do quantum error correction, right? And to do that, you'll need to do a number of gates. And so you need that you can do quantum error correction in order to protect the state in a time that's shorter than the time it takes to totally lose the state or to totally randomize it, even to totally dephase. Okay? So this, of course, is a very severe restriction. Most systems, particularly big macroscopic systems that it's much easier to build things out of, have decoherence times that are much, much shorter than any relevant control time that you have. And therefore, people look at basically this ratio of decoherence time to gate time as kind of a figure of merit for which systems are candidates for building quantum computers. And if you find one that where you can get a good ratio here, then it's something that's worth looking at as a possible way to build quantum computers. So of course, this can be realized in various ways, right? There's some systems that have very long decoherence times, but maybe the gates are relatively slow. And that's OK. So long as the gates are still faster than the decoherence time, you're OK. And then there are systems where the decoherence times are very, very short. And while you might think that's bad for quantum computing, again, it's OK if the gate operation time is even shorter. And so there are examples of systems that work both ways. Unfortunately, there's pretty few systems where the decoherence times are very, very long and the gate operation times are really, really short. But those systems are really good for quantum computing, in principle. I mean, there's these other properties you have to meet. And actually, there's a reason for that. It's not just kind of random, oh, it's bad luck. And the reason is that decoherence times tend to be set by the strength of how this system couples to the environment. Right? The environment tends to be a source of errors. But unfortunately, it's also a source of control. Because we're an environment for the system, we'd like to go in and do something to it. So we need some way to couple to the system strong enough to cause something to happen. And the strength of that coupling determines how fast you can do gates. And so therefore, there tends to be some linkage between them. But there is a difference between kind of the natural coupling to the environment and the intentional ones that you put on. And so that's why they don't have to be exactly the same. OK? The next criterion, a universal set of quantum gates. Okay, this one is maybe fairly clear. We talked about universal sets of quantum gates. In order to really call it a quantum computer, you should be able to do, in principle, an arbitrary unitary transformation, or at least something that's kind of equivalent to an arbitrary unitary transformation. Perhaps it works on some subspace of the total available Hilbert space. You don't need to use every possible state. Okay, and so to do this, well, you have some fundamental things that you can do, and you need to be able to put them together to get anything. So it needs to form a universal set. And then the fifth criterion is a qubit specific measurement capability. Okay, so you've done your computation, and at the end of it, well, you have to be able to measure and get the answer out. But it's a little bit more than that in this criterion. So this one says that your measurement shouldn't be some kind of gross expectation value measurement, although there's cases where that will work too. It's really best if you can take an individual qubit in your computer and measure it to get the answer. It's sufficient if you can do this only at the very end of the computation. And so there's some cases where this is like a destructive measurement. You know, you measure it, and then the computer is gone. But it's also very helpful if you can do this in the middle of the computation. Depending on exactly what your system is, then you know you might be able to do some class control that will let you do different things based on the outcome of the measurement. So an example is error correction, again, where you'd like to measure, find the error syndrome, and then process that classically, and then put it back into the computation in order to correct the error. If necessary, you can do that all with quantum circuitry. And for instance, in the cases where the gate operation time is very fast, you may need to do that. Or the, sometimes the measurement time is much longer than the decoherence time. That's fairly common, too. And so you may need to do that in that case, too. But it's certainly useful if you can convert to classical information when appropriate. Okay. So these are the basic DiVincenzo criteria for building a quantum computer. He later added two more that are useful for communication. And so those are So in these two criteria, he uses the phrase flying qubits to refer to qubits that kind of naturally move from one place to another. Personally, I think the order of these is kind of backwards. But so flying qubits, you should be able to send them from one specific place to another specific place. And the obvious example of this is a photon, right? Say in an optical fiber. That, you know, can store a quantum state, and it's very easy to move it from one place to another. You can control where it goes by where the optical fiber goes. Okay, so that's certainly necessary if you want to do any kind of communication. And then there's this criterion six, which is the ability to interconvert between stationary qubits and flying qubits. So this is maybe not completely necessary if you can do the computation directly on the flying qubits. That tends to be a little bit awkward, which is why it's helpful to be able to convert between qubits that naturally stay put, and maybe you can do gates between them relatively easily, and qubits which move from place to place. Okay? And if we have time today, I'll show you an example of these things as well. Okay? So then let's go into our first real example of implementation. This one I'll do in a fair amount of detail, which will probably take up the rest of today. And then tomorrow, I was thinking of going through a bunch more quickly to kind of give you a flavor of the other things that people have thought about. So the example I'm going to look at in detail is, I would say, certainly one of the leading candidates for building quantum computers. And that's ion traps. Okay. So the idea in ion traps is the qubits are going to be encoded as electronic states of ions trapped in some sort of magnetic bottle. So in particular, they like to use group 2 atoms. So these are for instance, calcium. And these are things that have 2 electrons in their outer shell. Okay, and they're going to be ionized once. So therefore, there's 1 electron in the outer shell. And the qubit is the state of that electron. Okay? And they tend to use a linear trap. And this is not particularly hard to do because they're charged atoms, right? They're ionized one, so they have charge plus 1. So they interact well with electric magnetic fields. And more than that, because they're charged, if you put multiple atoms in the same trap, they tend to repel each other. So for instance, if you have your trap here, then you might have a bunch of ions, and they tend to space out equally, more or less, within the trap. Yeah?
Since it's energetically favorable for the electrons to be on the same atom, so that if you complete that trial,
right,
how does one stop charge from hopping over to a different atom?
Well, so first of all, these atoms don't get that close to each other. Because they're positively charged, they stay with each other. I don't think it's all that energetically favorable in this case because they're not completing this outer shell. Right? I mean, there's only the two electrons is slightly more favorable than 1 electron,
yeah.
But it's not enough to complete the shell. So,
okay.
So they don't, I mean, if calcium doesn't like to form Ca2, it likes to map to connect up with some negative recharged ion, right? But that has a missing 1 electron from the outer shell rather than missing all but 1. Okay. So I don't think and in any case, like I said, they don't get that close to each other. So the chemistry of these is not a problem. But I mean, I think the source of these is basically, they take some calcium vapor, and I'm not sure exactly how they ionize it. They probably bombard it with something. I don't know. But and then the vapor doesn't naturally tend to recombine. Maybe if it gets cold enough, that would become a problem. But they trap it first, and then they can cool it down. Okay. Okay. So more than that, because they repel each other. So if one of these ions moves, one of these ions moves, Well, the others will move too. Okay, and so in fact, what will happen is you get some oscillations in this trap. So these are called phonon modes. It's really the same thing as phonons in solids, vibrational modes. And they're quantized, of course, because these are atoms, they're quantum particles. So in the simplest case, we're going to talk about the lowest mode, which is the sloshing mode. And that's where they all move in sync. So, so they all move this way, you know, together like this. And then, you know, the trap potential pushes them back. So they get pushed back the other way, and they all go back together like that. And so effectively, this is, at least you know, for small small vibrations, this is effectively a harmonic oscillator. And so it'll have some Hamiltonian, you know, like h bar nu a dagger a. OK? And so what they want to do, so I'm going to talk about the original Serac and Zoller proposal for the ion trap. It turns out that there's some that are slightly better in practice, but this one is easier to explain. And so what you want to do is you want to cool the phonon to essentially its vacuum. So of course, this doesn't literally mean that the particles are not moving at all, because there's you know some zero mode occupation here, right? There's a half h bar nu of oscillation, but essentially you can think about them as being stationary then, okay? And then over the course of the computation, we're going to excite up to one phonon at some point, and then cool it back down to zero. So it turns out that this is kind of tricky. This is actually very difficult to do in practice, to cool it all the way down to the vacuum state. And what's more, and in some ways more serious, is that there seems to be some problem in maybe oscillating electric potentials in these traps that tends to heat up this particular mode faster than they would really like. On a time scale, that's enough to cause problems in the computation. They can still do things with this mode, but the error rate is higher than they'd like. So they're not doing as well on this criterion as they wanted to. So there's kind of two solutions that have come out of this, which is, so for one thing, well, maybe three solutions. So for one thing, it turns out to be much better if you cool down the ion trap. Mostly they were doing these things at room temperature. But if you put it in some cryogenic system, then this heating problem doesn't go away, but it decreases quite a lot. Another solution is to use higher modes other than this mode, which I think has they may have may, the higher modes may be slightly anharmonic, and so it gets much more complicated. But you can still do things, and those are still heat up, but they're less vulnerable to the heating. And then the third solution is to find gate implementations that are less sensitive to really being in the ground state of the phonon, so that you still want it to be fairly cool, but it doesn't have to be all the way cool. OK? Yeah?
If the qubits are the electronic spins of the ions, mm-hmm. how I'm a little confused in why phonon heating would.
Right. Well, I haven't explained that yet. So but basically, the answer is that so we're going to use the phonon mode as, well, they call it a bus to interact the different qubits. Okay. for our implementation of a two-qubit gate is going to inherently use this phonon mode. And the reason we want to do that is because the phonon involves all the atoms. Okay? So it's going to be relatively easy to do things that affect one atom, but to do things that interact multiple atoms, we have to be a little more clever. Yeah?
Is the sloshing mode energy eigenstate of the harmonic oscillators? Or is it something
different? Sorry. So the harmonic oscillator, so each different vibrational mode is its own oscillator mode. Okay. So the harmonic oscillator, there's actually multiple. I mean, if you write this down more carefully, it's actually a sum over multiple different modes. Okay. And so the sloshing mode is the lowest frequency one.
Right. Okay. So you have multiple phonon wavelengths.
Right. Which in kind of the classical limit corresponds to a bigger amplitude for this mode versus a smaller amplitude. But in the quantum case, Okay. So then let's go to the qubits. So it turns out that in the original Serac-Zoller proposal, they use three electronic states. So two of them form your qubit. So you have ground and excited, and those will be 0 and 1. And then there's some other state that they use in one of the gates. Okay, and let me say that this energy splitting is E, and this one is E prime. Okay. So if you have a qubit that's in the ground or the excited state, so qubit and so if you have such a qubit, well, suppose you turn on a laser. And the frequency of this laser satisfies h bar omega is equal to E. Okay? So this laser frequency is exactly the energy difference between the ground and excited state. Or, you know, close enough that it makes no difference. Oh, I should say that these E and E prime states should be long-lived. Okay, so spontaneous emission is not going to be a big problem. They have very narrow line width. And so that's also good for when we excite the laser, because it means that there's no real broadening. So it's on the other hand, that means you have to get the frequency very close to the right energy level. But it also means that there's little chance of accidentally getting the other one. And again, there's all sorts of different variations on exactly how you want to do this, but this is the simplest way to explain. Yeah.
Is it normal to like have a laser that's naturally at the right frequency, or do you have to have some sort of pi/2?
Yeah. So this is one of these dark arts, I think, that the experimentalists, though, that I tend to ignore when the experimentalists talk about it. This goes into the choice of the atom. You know, you want an atom that has states that are kind of convenient places. Both. So first of all, the states have to be, you know, nice, stable, long-lived states. And it's also good if the difference between them is something that you can access easily with some particular useful kind of laser. So there are lasers that have very tunable frequencies. So you have a certain amount of freedom there. But on the other hand, you know, there are other kinds of lasers that are very nice that have, you know, some particular frequency that they like to use. And so when I said there's variations for how to do this, specifically I was thinking that some of them, like I think Dave Weinland's group, like to use Raman pulses. So this difference here is actually not close to the laser. They use two different lasers to excite up and then excite down from yet another intermediate state.
Oh,
dear. So anyway, like I said, there's all sorts of variations for how to do this. And that's nice, because So one of the big problems is that with lasers is that the frequencies tend to wander a bit. Okay, and this needs to be tuned just to the right thing. And So the difference of laser frequencies is a bit more stable, or you can make it a bit more stable. And this is the real expertise that distinguishes somebody who's really good at ion traps from bad at ion traps, is their ability to stabilize the laser frequency, I think. I mean, there's other tricks too, but that's being really good with lasers is one of the big ones. So anyway, so somehow, at least at the very gross theoretical level, you get a laser to the right frequency. And so that lets you interact this ground and excited state. And what happens is you get what's called a Rabi oscillation, which is really just a rotation in the Hilbert space spanned by ground and excited. So for instance, the ground state will go to cosine theta t ground plus sine theta t excited. And the excited state would then go to, I guess, minus sine theta t ground plus cos theta t excited. Okay, this is while the laser's on and coupling these two. There can be some additional phases that appear here because of the phase of the laser. But I'm going to simplify and ignore those. Although I think that if you're actually doing this right, you have to take those into account. So the idea here is, well, you start with the ground, say, and then you cycle. And if you go for half a cycle, then you'll have a superposition, ground plus excited. And then if you keep going, you'll eventually have only excited. And I mean, so if you were to measure, I haven't told you how to do that yet, but if you measure, you see that the probability of ground and excited goes in a nice trigonometric function. I guess it would actually be cosine squared, because you know, these are amplitudes, and you get a probability. Okay, this is kind of one of the first experiments that anyone wants to do when they build a quantum computer. So not all of them show a nice oscillation, Rabi oscillation. But the point is, this is evidence that you have real coherence in the system, right? That you're seeing superpositions. Okay, because if you can go to this point where you have a superposition of ground plus excited, and you keep your laser on, well, then you get to the pure excited state again. And then you can get back, and you get this revival, where you get back to the ground state. And see what happens if you have a bad decoherence time. Bad meaning short. So this is good decoherence time. Sorry, it's too small to read, I know. So good decoherence time looks like that. The bad decoherence time instead looks something like this. You start off at 1, and then maybe you go down almost to 0. But then the oscillations very quickly die off. Okay? And you're just left with a mixed state of ground and excited. Okay? And once you have that, well, you can't ever get a pure ground state or a pure excited state very easily. Yeah?
Stupid question. So you drew it stabilizing to a mixed state in which the probabilities of ground and excited are both 1/2. Mm-hmm. Intuitively, I'd expect that if you just like couple this thing to a random environment, if you entangle it, it will go to precisely that state. Like it'll never go to a mixed state where the probabilities are like 75% and 25%.
So well, actually, so these are ground excited state, right? So they have different energies. So you might expect the thermal state to have more ground state than excited. And so I don't actually know if you get a half to a half. But in the specific case where you have a laser coupling them, the laser is mixing them up in any case.
Okay.
So that's kind of making up the energy difference.
If you just coupled it to a random environment, you would just take like the maximum entropy quantum.
Yeah. So there's two things going on here. So one of them is decoherence, as in the Zurich sense of dephasing, right? So there, if you have a superposition state, well, it'll decohere to a mixture, but with the weights that are whatever, you know, the amplitudes become squared, the amplitudes get squared, they become probabilities. And so you have, and if you have alpha 0 plus beta 1, that becomes probability alpha squared of 0 and probability beta squared of 1. And so that could be anything depending on what you started with. In this particular experiment where you're going up and down, probably it'll end up in the mix, in the middle, because it gets mixed. The other thing is that there's a time scale for, say, the excited state to decay into the ground state. Okay, or maybe for the ground state to absorb a photon from the environment and get excited to the excited state. And in a lot of systems, that time scale is longer, or at least a lot of systems that people work on for quantum computing, that time scale is longer. It doesn't have to be. But that's the time scale that's relevant for thermalization, where you actually get a thermal mixed state. Okay? So, yeah?
What determines the value of theta there?
Oh, so so theta, I mean, there's a couple of factors. So one of them is the coupling of the laser to this mode. But the other one is just the intensity of the laser. OK, so that's the thing that you can control most easily. So you can control, I mean, it doesn't really matter because you can trade it off with t. But But there's a bunch of trade-offs here. So you can run it for as much time as you want, right? So if you set theta very low, you can compensate by leaving it on for a very long time. The problem with that, of course, is that the slower you do it, well, the less you're winning over decoherence time. Okay, so so that seems bad. But on the other hand, if you crank up theta by making the laser very intense, well, you're shining a lot of light on the atom. And that can cause all sorts of problems, right? I mean, it can excite other states. So, I mean, I said that these states are very narrow. So maybe you don't have to worry about exciting E prime accidentally. But there's other electronic states in these atoms that are not very long-lived. And they might have very broad line width. And so you shine a lot of light at one frequency, and you might still accidentally excite a transition to one of these other states. And that state, since it's broad, it would decay, and that would cause decoherence. And then you also have to worry a little bit about the lasers hitting the other atoms, not just the one that you're shining on. Even a strong laser will shift the energy levels in the atoms, too. There's AC Stark effect, stuff like that. So you have to worry about that. So all these things will set a limit on how much intensity you actually want. But in practice, these single qubit gates, they can do them to very high accuracy, and the time is relatively short compared to the two qubit gates. Okay?
So this is used to implement your Hadamard?
Yeah. So for instance, you can use this for the Hadamard. You can do a lot more things, right? You can do rotation by any angle in this. This is not exactly the Hadamard. The signs are not set up quite right, but basically it's a Hadamard. But you have a whole continuous spectrum gate. And so what about phase gates? You can also do phase gates very easily. Well, how do you do that? Well, the ground state has some energy, and the excited state has a higher energy, higher by E, right? So if you don't do anything, the ground state and the excited state will acquire different phases over time. So all you have to do is wait. Right? And so then say the ground state, you can assume it just goes to the ground state. And the excited state will go to the minus I E T over H bar excited. OK? So that's a phase gate.
Is that to not do a phase gate, you have to time things very precisely?
Yes. So in particular, if you don't want to do a phase gate, you should keep track of time. So that you know how much it's phased by. So it's kind of a matter of definitions of what the phase of this basis state and what the phase of the excited state is. Again, a whole story that one could do about, there's also the phase of the laser, which also has some impact here. And so you have to keep this in sync relative to the laser. But in practice, for ion traps, this is not very hard, because these frequencies are relatively large. Okay, so that's 1-qubit gates. Any other questions about those?
How do you implement an X-gate?
An X-gate? Oh, well, that's easy. You just run this one for theta t equals pi over 2.
Yeah, sorry.
Yeah. So obviously, these two by themselves don't immediately give you everything. But by alternating between them in some appropriate way, well, you know, you can use Euler angles or whatever to decompose an arbitrary single qubit rotation into some combination of this and this. Okay? Okay. So then let's talk about 2-qubit gates. So for 2-qubit gates, as I said, we're going to need the phonon mode. And we're really just going to need one kind of 2-qubit gate. So I told you before that the controlled knot plus single qubit gates was universal. So basically, that's what we're going to use. We're not going to use the controlled knot exactly. We're going to use a phase gate. But it's almost the same. So for a 2-qubit gate, we use the phonon knot. So how does this work? Well, so if we instead instead of tuning a laser to this frequency E, we tune it to slightly less than E. So in particular, if we have omega plus nu is equal to E, then the states will couple to the phonon mode. So for instance, here we have the ground and an excited state. And these are the energy levels with zero phonons. And here we have one phonon, and then two phonons, et cetera. Okay? And this energy difference, of course, is E. This energy difference is h bar nu. Okay? And so then this energy difference is E minus h bar nu. And that's what gets excited by the laser. Well, no. So nu is given to you by the phonon mode. Oh, but you can control that a little bit by adjusting the trap potential.
Right. No, I meant with a laser.
Omega. We choose omega. Omega is the laser frequency. Okay. So yeah. So we choose a laser that has this frequency. And again, you need a laser that's somewhat tunable, so you can figure this out right. Okay. And then the idea is, so in particular, the laser couples the excited state with zero phonons to the ground state with one phonon. Okay? So if we shine a laser like this on a particular atom, if you start with a state like alpha ground plus beta excited and no phonon modes, you'll get alpha ground with no phonon mode, or no phonons, plus beta ground with one phonon. In other words, the ground state factors out, and you transferred the qubit state to the state of the phonon, alpha 0 plus beta 1. Okay? Yeah?
There's one thing that I understand. So you have a system which is basically a bunch of point particles. Well, first, it's a bunch of point particles sitting in a potential, and they're all, of course, it's a multi-body thing, so the potential will sort of look very complicated in the multi-body.
Yeah, I mean, you can approximate it as something that's not too bad.
Okay, so you have a bunch of particles sitting in this potential, and each point particle is a two-level system.
You have, again, at some level of approximation. Right. We're about to use a third level, but okay.
Right. So you have, so your state space is a tensor product, is an n-fold tensor product of the system made of a two-level system tensored with a particle in a one-dimensional.
So that's the approximation we're working with. Again, since we're only using the lowest mode, we'll ignore the other modes. We'll ignore the other electronic state. So yes, so we have a tensor product of n two-dimensional Hilbert spaces and one infinite dimensional harmonic oscillator over space.
Well, that's sort of maybe what I'm wondering about. Like, just looking at that system, what I would see is, what I would say is that the state of each, like, the state space of each atom is a free particle, or not a free particle, it's a particle on a line tensored with a two-level system.
Sure.
And so does it turn out that if you tensor a bunch of those together, you get...
Well, so, I mean, first of all, it's not really, the spatial mode is not a particle on line, because even if there's no other atoms, it's in a trap, right? So there's a trapping potential. So let's assume it's a harmonic trapping potential.
But the
state space, it's a harmonic oscillator.
Like, the state space is L squared R, and then there's some potential which is a harmonic oscillator potential.
Okay, sure, if you like. But, I mean, that kind of cuts off, anyway.
Yeah.
The point is, if you look at a single particle, sure, it has this degree of freedom in spatial movement.
Right.
So if you look at all the vibrational modes of these things, then you'll kind of recover that original idea of all the atoms being able to move independently. So we're simplifying. I mean, we're kind of throwing away the internal state at the moment.
Right.
If you look at the states, the motional states of the atom. It's convenient to rewrite those in terms of the collective motions that you see in the trap. And in that case, the kind of lowest one is the sloshing mode, and then you get this breathing mode where they kind of move like this, is the next one, and so on up the chain. We're going to ignore all the higher oscillation modes and just focus on the breathing, on the sloshing.
Right. So your whole system is, at first it looks like an n-body two-level times moving particle system, and then you can split it up into an n-body two-level system tensored with an n-body two-particle system. An n-body two-level system tensored with an n-body moving particle system. The n-body moving particle system in this potential is just a crystal, essentially. So it has phonon modes. And then the two-level systems just have, those 2 to the n excited and ground states.
Right.
So the spectrum of the entire system is a bunch of, is multiples of the excited ground energy difference, and then plus multiples of the harmonic oscillator energy.
Obviously, right, because you have lots of different harmonic oscillators potentially, so it can get pretty complicated, particularly since these are not actually, linear, the harmonic oscillator, the different harmonic oscillators here are not linear multiples of each other.
Okay.
But, yeah.
So this is where the assumption that we've managed to cool the phonon mode comes in?
Yeah, absolutely. So if at this point we had some kind of heating event, or for that matter cooling event, where the phonon escaped, that would cause an error in this particular qubit that's been transferred. So this is why it's really important that the phonon really be interrupted. And similarly, if the phonon were in some mixed state of, you know, sometimes 0, sometimes 1, sometimes 2, this whole interaction would get messed up. So the particular way we're going to do it is, in fact, very sensitive to being, you know, starting at 0 and then going to a superposition of 0 plus 1. But that's what I mean, that there are some ways that are less sensitive that would work just as well if you start in 2 phonons. It maybe doesn't work so well if you have a big mixture of 2 phonons and 10 phonons, but at least it doesn't require total cooling. Okay, so how exactly do we do this 2-qubit gate? So in particular, first we're going to couple, as I said, we're going to couple E0 to G1 for atom 1. to move its qubit into the phonon. Okay, and so the second step is then we want to interact with the second atom. And the idea is, well, now the qubit is in the phonon mode, which interacts equally well with any atom. So again, we want to interact the phonon and the atom. So to do that, this one gets a little subtle, and I won't pretend that I understand the details of it exactly myself. But I think what you do is, for the second atom, so first you convert the G state to an E prime state. So this is where this excited level. And then we perform, or we create a coupling between this E prime state Let's make it the E, just for simplicity. No, right, it's not right. So for atom 2, here's what we're going to do. We're going to create a coupling between the E 1 state, which is what we have when the qubit, the first qubit is in the 1 state, and the E prime 0 state. So to do this, we need to tune the laser to an energy difference. Well, first of all, the difference between E prime and E is big E prime minus big E. And then we need to shift that by nu. Yeah?
Sorry, coupling. Do you mean perform a unitary transformation that swaps those?
Well, so in particular, what I want to do is turn on a laser with frequency E prime minus E minus H prime nu. Okay? So, and then we have to figure out how long to run this laser.
Yeah, okay.
And what we actually want to do is you want to run it for kind of a half cycle,
which
for some reason is referred to as a 2-pi pulse. And the reason that it's a half cycle is because it gives you an overall minus sign.
Right.
So we don't actually want to change to this state. That would kind of be annoying. We want to just go through it and get back to where we started, but with a minus sign. And the point is, we only get the minus sign if we started with the E1 state. Okay?
When you said couple over there, you wrote a transformation that's taking times 0.
Yeah.
Times 1.
So and the difference is the time. So this one is the pi pulse.
Okay.
Okay. So this one actually it does the bit flip essentially within this particular two level subspace. Okay. And for this one, we do a 2 pi pulse and we get a minus 7. Okay. So. So what's the idea here? Well, if we started with E0, so I'm going to repurpose this slightly so that this is E prime down here instead of G. But if we started with E0, no, sorry, this is supposed to be E and this is E prime. So if we started with E0 down here, well, then there's nothing over here. There's no minus 1 phonon state to couple to. Right, this is why it's important that we started with 0 phonons, because if it was E2, then we'd actually couple. If the first qubit is in the state 0, then the phonon is 0, and that's what we have, E0. Or we have G if the second qubit is in the state 0. Right? In that case, it doesn't couple to anything, right? It's not involved in this interaction at all. Okay? So there's four possibilities, right? So we could have G0, nothing happens. G1, nothing happens. E0, nothing happens. But E1, something happens. Here, let me write that more carefully. So and then, of course, the last step is going to be undo step one. So we put the qubit back into the original state. So let's consider the original possibility. So we started with one of four possibilities. So in this case, nothing happened in step one. Then in step two, P0G. Then in step two, it stayed the same. And then in step three, of course, still stays the same. And if we had this, again, nothing happens in step one. Sorry, P0E. And in this case, we have the E0 state, which doesn't couple to anything. Right, because again, there's no minus one phonon mode. So this one stays as G0E. And then this puts it back, leaves it as G0E. And so in this case, well, the first step moves the excited state into the phonon. But we have a G state in second atom, so the second step doesn't do anything. And this maps us back to E0G in the third step. And then in the EE state, that's the case where something interesting happens. The first step maps us into the phonon mode. And then the E1 state gets this minus sign in the second step. So we get minus G1E. And then we map the phonon mode back into the original state, excited state, and assume it E0E. Okay? So in other words, we have a controlled phase gate, or controlled sign gate, 1, 1, 1, minus 1. And actually, it turns out that so you can write this, say, as controlled Z if you want. And this is actually equal to a simple circuit to the controlled NOT gate. OK? Wow, I'm over time already. OK, so let me just quickly then. Yeah?
Sorry. That part is self-inverse, right?
Yes.
OK, and you can do a part using that?
Using one qubit case, yeah.
OK.
So, I mean, basically, you don't necessarily need to literally convert it to a controlled
right.
model. But you could. And my main point in doing this is that, well, I already told you that controlled knot plus one qubit gate are universal. So this means that the controlled sine gate plus one qubit gate is also universal. So then the last thing I need to tell you is about measurement. So to do measurement in the ion trap, frequently what they do is they invoke yet another state. So here's G, here's E, and here's some other excited state. But F is short-lived. So it'll spontaneously emit back to the ground state. In a very short time. Okay. So what they do to measure whether you have a ground or excited is they shine a laser at this frequency. Okay. And then in the absence of spontaneous emission, you'd get Rabi oscillation between ground and this F state. But then because you do have spontaneous emission, you look for the emitted photons. Right? That's light. That's easy to see. And in fact, because this goes back to the ground state, if you started with the ground state, it'll go up to the excited state, you'll see an emitted photon, and it'll go back up to the excited state, and you'll see another emitted photon. So you get lots of them if you started with the ground state. So this is called a cycling transition. But if you started with the excited state, you don't see anything. Right? Because the laser is only coupling the ground state to the Z state. And the excited state is off at some other energy, and it doesn't get coupled. OK? So this lets you make a measurement between 0 and 1, right? Because if you see light, you know it's a 0. If you don't see light, you know it's a 1. And they can do this to get measurements with extremely high fidelity. Yes?
Obviously, doing this like collapses. If you had a superposition of exciting ground states, doing this would collapse it, even if nobody was watching. And the
of
reason
course.
Is, yeah, because when you do this, you're entangling the qubit with the electromagnetic field.
Yeah, so this the mode of the emitted photon, or the emitted photon, yeah, it gets it.
There may not be an emitted photon, but...
Well, there will be. That's the point. It's because with extremely high probability, the photons get emitted from this spontaneous emission.
I mean, if you're in an entangled state like half G plus half A, then there's...
Sorry, half G plus half E.
Right.
Then the ground state will see... Oh, yeah, so... Yeah, so sorry.
Sorry.
So whether or not they're emitted photons...
Yeah.
Becomes entangled with the state of this qubit.
Yes.
That's what you meant.
Yeah.
Oh, yes, okay. Right. And if it's E, there's no emitted photons. If it's G, there are. And that's right. So, I mean, whether there's intentionally anybody looking, really,
right.
actually almost never matters because the measurement device is itself going to entangle with some big
yeah.
register. And that's really what Ether gives it. OK, so I wouldn't be surprised if there's people ready to barge through the door now. So maybe we should finish there. And like I said, I'll talk about some other kinds of implementations tomorrow.